So I'm gonna
do an introduction of you and the series, and then I'm going to ask you a first question about geography at Berkeley. Okay.
Yep. Absolutely.
Okay. So it sounds all right, Mary. This sounds.
Sounds all right.
Hello, this is Cal Winslow. I want to welcome you to the second in our series of KZYX special programs on environmental and social issues of concern here in Northern California and Mendocino County. This series continues discussions begun at the highly successful conference on community and ecology sponsored by the Mendocino Institute in Casper in February. I'm the director of the Mendocino Institute. It's a not-for-profit education and research center located on the coast. You can find out more at www.mendocinoinstitute.org. Today our guest is Professor Michael Watts of the Geography Department at the University of California, Berkeley. Michael is a teacher, a scholar, and an activist. He's produced many books, including Economies of Violence, Liberation Ecologies, The Curse of Black Gold, Global Political Ecology, Violent Environments. He's a co-author of Afflicted Powers, Capital and Spectacle in a New Age of War. Michael's also been the director for 10 years of the Institute for International Studies at Berkeley. He's been the director of the Center for African Studies, and he's a founder of the Environmental Politics Workshop. Michael's also known to many here in Mendocino County. We've been privileged to host Michael with visiting scholars, environmentalists, and activists from far and wide, Nigeria, Zimbabwe, Indonesia, Brazil, as over the past decade, he has enabled students and scholars working in Berkeley to visit here as well, meeting with local activists and coastal environmentalists. He lives with his family in San Francisco. And finally, with a little luck, you just might find him Sunday morning at the Sheep Dog trials. Keep your eyes out. Today we've asked Michael to speak about the politics of oil. Michael, you're there?
Yes, I am, Cal. Thank you very much for the invitation to participate today.
Michael, could you begin by telling us a little about geography as a discipline at Berkeley and how it's become a center for environmental studies?
Yes, I'd be happy to. I suspect many of your readers are probably exposed to geography in a quite sort of tangential way. Geography is not institutionalized as a discipline in the United States in the same way that it is in Europe, for example, where geography is taught through primary, high school, and it's a major discipline in all universities, one of the largest of the social sciences. That's not the case here, actually, and most kids in high school get a little exposure to something called geography through, you know, social studies or some course of that sort. And typically that entails, you know, a sort of an introduction to maps, cartography, and so on. And that's certainly an important part of the discipline. And there are certainly people in geography today who continue that cartographic type of tradition. They typically do it, of course, through computer-generated maps and so on. Geographic information systems is the current parlance. But the heart of geography actually resides elsewhere. I mean, the meaning of the word really is the study of the landscape, of the surface of the earth. And that's really about two related sorts of things. It's about, on the one hand, the biophysical side of the landscape, and that's why in all geography departments, including my own, you know, there are biophysical scientists, climatologists, geomorphologists, people who study rivers, climate, and so on, and do that as physical scientists. But on the other hand, there is a social science side, what we call human geography, which looks typically at how human activity has transformed that biophysical environment and with what consequences and what to do about it. So just to give you a simple example, in my own department, we have people who study global climate change. They do that as climate scientists, and they look at aerosols and methane and carbon emissions and how that changes the dynamics of climate with huge consequences. And on the other hand, one has people who look at how human practice, what's the political economy of carbon emissions in relationship to petroleum consumption, and what therefore needs to be done in terms of regulating those carbon emissions and so on. So it's the combination of those things which makes geography, I think, a very unusual discipline, linking, if you like, the environment with human practice or political economy. And I think that attracts particularly now lots of students who are interested in critical thinking about those sorts of environmental resource questions as they pertain to human sustainability on the Earth.
As connected to geography at Berkeley and what students were doing?
Sorry, Cal, do you want me to repeat what I said before?
No,
do you want me to just do it?
Just pick up where you left off, and,
okay,
and it'll be edited to be smooth.
Got it, okay. So geography's concern really with how human societies have transformed the face of the Earth and transformed biophysical systems with what consequences, which is really a type of environmental studies, I suppose you'd say, of course has attracted a great deal of attention, you know, in the last 20, 30 years when the whole question of what constitutes sustainability under capitalism has become such a dominant question. So the sorts of students, undergraduate, graduate, get attracted to geography right now are especially driven, of course, by the huge challenges associated with the short, medium, long-term impacts of global climate change. This is obviously of extraordinary consequence and includes both an understanding of what are the dynamics of climate change, what and how different sorts of emissions, methane or carbon or aerosols, how that's transforming climate dynamics, and what that would imply for things like changing patterns of climate globally, changing sea level rise, obviously, and what sorts of changes, what sorts of human responses this will involve in order to both reduce carbon emissions and necessarily to change the styles of life that we live in order to ensure that we live on a planet that's inhabitable for human occupancy.
Yes. Much of your own work has involved, in the recent period, I think, has involved oil. Is that right?
And that is correct.
And in the Niger Delta?
Absolutely. I've looked in particular at one part of the global oil industry, and that's especially at the increasing role played by Africa as a supplier of oil and gas, not only to the U.S., market where it's used especially in the gasoline sector, but increasingly and very importantly, Africa supplying oil and gas to China. And as you all know, China's emerged as a major consumer, second only now in total quantity to the U.S. of oil and gas products. And
has this helped to frame your own thinking about the politics of oil more generally, what you've seen in Nigeria?
It has. I mean, I went to Nigeria in the early 1970s, Cal, not necessarily to study oil or energy. I actually went there to look at issues surrounding famine and food security. This was at a time when that part of the world, like Somalia in the press today, was suffering a major famine, and I wanted to understand what the relationship was to drought and whether, in fact, as the press was saying, drought was actually the cause of famine or whether there were other forces at work. But it just so happened that when I was there in Nigeria, this was during the 1970s, during the first oil crisis as it became cold, when in fact Nigeria was just becoming a major oil producer. And overnight, Nigeria was awash in oil money, became a major producer. It now produces over 2.5 million barrels a day. It's a member of OPEC, you know, the cartel, which has a dominant role in the global oil and gas industry. And it was awash in money, and it unleashed a whole series of changes that were very evident to me in the 1970s. And it was that, really, that began to shape my interest in the oil industry, in the ecological footprint of the oil and gas industry in places like Nigeria, and indirectly, the huge human and environmental costs of our dependency on petroleum.
Would it be fair to say that you became an activist of sorts as well?
It was. I mean, back in the 70s when I was a graduate student. I've been certainly shaped by your mentor, Edward Thompson, and sort of left political economy, and I went, as I said, to study food shortage and famine with the idea that it was precisely how food markets worked or did not work and who had power and purchasing power in the marketplace that was important in understanding who did and did not starve. I was in Nigeria originally working in the early 1970s and ended up doing some work for Oxfam during that famine, and in all the time that I was there, I never saw an absolute scarcity of food. There was always food available. It was simply that some, many people, couldn't afford the prices. And so that got me interested in markets and political economy and so on. And so I always had that interest. And when I then began to look more critically at the oil and gas industry, I certainly think that I was, if you like, shaped by that experience and began to see in a very different sector now, oil and gas, which was obviously dominated by, at that point, by, you know, transnational oil companies, big powerful governments, and so on. I began to explore that critically, using that toolkit in a sense that I'd tried to develop in studying food and famine and human suffering in that part of the world.
And I think you've also been involved in what seems to be or have been a very powerful environmental movement focused on the Delta. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, you asked, in a sense, why I began to look at oil critically. And one answer to that question was that the Niger Delta, which is a huge delta, 60,000 square kilometers in the southeast of Nigeria, an area of magnificent tropical rainforest, mangrove swamps, the largest freshwater swamps in all of Africa, actually, a remarkable environment. The ecological footprint of the industry in that part of the world, and incidentally, it's not terribly different in Louisiana or other great oil-producing regions, the ecological footprint of the industry has been absolutely devastating. I mean, your listeners will certainly be aware of the catastrophic impact of the Deepwater Horizon catastrophe in the Gulf of Mexico last year, where a rig owned by or operated by BP exploded and sank. Now, that catastrophe fed something like 5 million barrels of crude into the Gulf Stream, into the Gulf, with consequences that were terrifically profound. And it initiated a whole debate, as you know, in the United States here about why, in fact, we and oil companies in general were now trying to get access to this black stuff in 5,000 feet of water through 20,000 feet of sediments, you know, 50, 60, 70 miles out into the Gulf of Mexico. And the ecological risks and dangers, yet alone through carbon emissions, but of these sorts of catastrophic spills when you're operating in very difficult environments. Well, that catastrophe of that order that we were so galvanized by last year, an equivalent oil spill has happened in the Niger Delta of that order of magnitude every year over the last 50 years in which Nigeria has been a major producer of oil. So it's, if you like, had successive massive oil spills over that period, and it led the World Wildlife Fund a couple of years ago to describe the Niger Delta as one of the most polluted environments on the face of the earth. So when you say the ecological costs and the ecological consequences of the industry are an important part in terms of both mobilization within Nigeria and outside of it, it speaks directly to these catastrophic consequences of the industry, which incidentally is not just in terms of oil spills, that's one thing, but the environment itself, and in this case in the Niger Delta, it's an agricultural and fishing environment, a very delicate ecology, has been devastated by all of the ancillary activities that occur around the industry, especially dredging of rivers and channels, the disruption of the ecology, deforestation, and so on, spills, as I've mentioned, and also, very importantly, gas flaring, where gas, which is released as a result of pumping oil, is burned. And this produces particulate matter, all sorts of consequences for the environment and for human health. So all of this environmental disaster, if you like, has been a major factor in why Niger Delta has become such a such an important example of the type of destructive consequences of the oil and gas industry, which, of course, we as American consumers who consume this stuff essentially are complicit with in some way or another.
And I think maybe more than that, isn't there a California connection, namely the Chevron Corporation?
Of course. You know, there are a number of major oil companies who are active in Nigeria, and most of them, incidentally, operate in joint ventures with the Nigerian government, and Chevron is one of them. Shell, actually, is the largest lifter of oil and gas, but Chevron, AGIP, ENI, Total, all of the so-called majors are present in Nigeria. It's actually Shell that has probably, of course, received much of the bad press in and around the Niger Delta, because it was Shell which was implicated in the extraordinary events that surrounded the hanging of a Nigerian activist who had, Kensara Wiwa, who had mobilized his community, the Ogoni people, in the 1990s against Shell precisely for their environmental record in the Delta. And it was out of that movement led by Kensara Wiwa that, backed by international environmental groups like Greenpeace and so on, that the Niger Delta issue really reached the global sort of screen, if you like. It became a visible global case that received a great deal of press and attention. Of course, Kensara Wiwa was himself hung in 1995 by the Nigerian junta, the Nigerian military that were then in power. And that whole movement was quashed. But what Kensara Wiwa's movement did was to really unleash a whole set of other popular movements around the impact of oil, who benefited from it, the need for environment, the need for compensation for environmental damage. And really that was Kensara Wiwa's legacy, both within Nigeria and indeed within other African oil-producing countries that have very similar sorts of problems.
Well, let's shift our discussion a bit. But first of all, I'd like to say that this is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow, and today we're talking to Professor Michael Watts, a professor of geography at the University of California, Berkeley, and we're talking about the politics of oil as part of a special series that KZYX is hosting every Wednesday afternoon at 1 o'clock for the next month or so. Well, so, Michael, let me shift a bit. I wanted to ask you a question about a book you helped produce called Afflicted Powers. You write in that of the giant 2003 anti-war demonstrations, if there was a single political thread tying the anti-war mobilizations together, it was undoubtedly no blood for oil. And you write, a flotilla of signs rang variants on the idea, and on Market Street in San Francisco, it was the Chevron headquarters, not Bechtel, not Carlyle or Starbucks, that goaded the marchers to their most vocal dissent. And reading on, you raise some concerns about this as a central slogan for the movement. And I wonder if you could explain, and please take your time here, because I know that this is a complicated issue. But, you know, in the news, of course, we have another war in yet another oil-producing country, Libya.
Absolutely. Well, in that book, and if you remember, Cal, you and I were at those marches in San Francisco in 2003. But in that book, one of the things that we were trying to do was to sort of, on the one hand, acknowledge the extraordinary strategic importance of oil. So one needs to start rightly and properly, as the No Blood for Oil campaign, if you like, rightly expressed, the idea that oil became, and cheap oil became, the basis of what we could call hydrocarbon capitalism. It's the energy of our modern economic system. And the history of that, and some of your listeners may have read or know about the big fat book by Daniel Yergin called The Prize, which documents the rather grotesque and violent history of oil from really the end of the 19th century, and how oil and the history of the Middle East was very much wrapped up with empire, conquest, occupation. Industrializing imperial powers, desperate to get this new energy source, which was incidentally central, as Churchill pointed out, to the new military of the early 21st century, to get this oil by any means possible, if you like. And they did that through what was then called the concessional system, which essentially the big oil companies, whether they were Russian or French or American or British, essentially acquired massive parts of what is now the Middle East and simply ran them as their corporate fiefdoms. So on the one hand, then, that's the history of oil, and many of your listeners know the more recent history, where, particularly when it became clear in the 1920s, that domestic production of oil was incapable of meeting the growing industrial demand in the United States. Oil, of course, was central to Texas and parts of the Southwest and so on as a major supplier, but that oil was limited, and it was clear by the 1920s that they would have to turn elsewhere. And we know the story that the U.S. turned in its global acquisition strategy for oil, as Michael Clare has called it, to Venezuela, to Iran, and Saudi Arabia. And they supported a whole series of regimes, corrupt if necessary, in order to ensure that the oil continued to flow. Of course, from the vantage point of the present, that strategy fell apart in the last 20 years or so. After all, after the Iranian Revolution, after the rise of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, and particularly since we're celebrating or memorializing the events of September 11, the way in which out of Saudi Arabia, this great historical ally, emerged radical Islamism, these three pillars of this oil strategy, of course, fell apart. But the undeniable fact is that a lot of U.S. foreign policy was built around ensuring that that oil continued to flow. And if it required military intervention or if it required enhancing the powers of companies and corporations to get it, they did so. So that's the big oil story that everyone knows, and it's terribly important. In that book, what we were trying to suggest, however, was to say, not that that isn't important, but does that really provide a powerful account, or indeed a primary reason for the U.S. occupation and imperial expansion into Iraq in 2003? Was it simply only or primarily about getting that oil? And was that oil in 2003 an absolute indispensable necessity because of something called peak oil? In other words, this idea that oil is finite, we've reached some tipping point where we've reached a point at which global output has peaked, and one needed to, as it were, open up Iraq in some way or another, because it's after Saudi Arabia has the largest proven reserves. And what we tried to suggest in that book, then, was simply the idea that one would be naive if one were to say that oil wasn't relevant to the decision to invade. But it wasn't necessarily that that occurred solely because of oil, because oil was running scarce, we'd reached peak oil. Certainly that was not the case. And in fact, there were, at that point, the oil market had spare capacity. And there's a whole debate over, indeed, whether we are at peak oil or even close to peak oil. And even if we are, none of this would imply that somehow this global oil spigot is going to be turned off tomorrow. And what we tried to say was that rather than being concerned with oil per se, perhaps we should be concerned with, in a sense, what oil represented, which was an attempt to impose through Iraq and send a signal to the Mideast and to the rest of the world, a type of neoliberal project. Because don't forget, what the oil industry represented more than anything else, and in a sense still does, is one of the most regulated and unmarket-like systems that one can imagine. I mean, rather than having free markets, we have an oligopoly of big oil companies. Rather than free markets, we have a cartel called OPEC. And indeed, the whole way in which prices are determined in the oil market has nothing to do, or very little to do, with supply and demand, but actually to do with the deliberate regulation of output. The history of oil is about the history of managing surpluses of oil in order to keep prices from crashing completely. So what we're trying to say here then was not that oil was absolutely insignificant, but let's not mistake oil for what in some sense is what oil represented in the U.S. invasion, which we saw was really about an American neoliberal agenda imposed militarily. And we referred to that as military neoliberalism. So it was trying to put oil and no blood for oil in a slightly different context, in some sense to get those thousands of marchers or to encourage critiques of the occupation, not just around those big bad oil companies, as big and bad as they may be, but around in some sense what they represented more generally, which was the imposition of a type of American neoliberal hegemony.
Well, as long as we're here at peak oil, I'm sure you're aware there's a great deal of concern about peak oil all over the place, I guess, but certainly here in Northern California. And there's significant worry about the possibility of an actual shortage of oil as fuel and what that might mean for people every place, but especially in isolated areas like Mendocino County. I wonder if you could say just a few words about what you think the situation is as far as the supply of oil and the way that the debate goes and what sides you think are represented in the debate. Could you help us with that a bit?
Well, I think the peak oil issue is very, very important. I mean, peak oil was this notion that was developed by an American geologist, a petrogeologist, King Hubbard, who simply pointed out that the United States has a limited amount of oil in its reservoirs located in the U.S., and that's finite. And at a certain point, as consumption increased and as output increased, it would reach a peak oil, and then continue to decline. I mean, it seems to me that that is absolutely true. Oil is finite. It's, at least in human history, or in human time frames, it's not renewable. Of course, it is renewable in some long-term geological sense, but it's not renewable. So that notion of a peak oil is not a fiction. It's true. The problem is, there are several problems, however, as I see it, with peak oil. One is that if you just go on the web, you will see, in fact, a huge difference of opinion on, in global terms, when peak oil has arrived in some opinions or will arrive in others. If you take a look at the U.S. Geological Survey, if you look at some of the big oil companies, if you look at the International Energy Agency, they all have wildly different estimates. Some, for example, as suggested, it's already passed in 2010. Some that it's coming in 2047. Some have even suggested that it won't be until the early or mid part of the next century. And that huge debate is very much wrapped up with all of the problems of actually determining how much oil there actually is. We're constantly finding new oil. How much of that oil is recoverable from the reservoirs? And that changes with given types of technology. And so for all of these reasons, the actual amount of stuff that there is, and therefore what's going to peak and when, is rather difficult to calculate. And it's certainly the case that even if and when peak oil is reached, whenever that will be, it's not as if suddenly oil will disappear tomorrow. It's rather that the amount of oil that's there to be drawn down will, by definition, be limited. And human society will, whatever one thinks about global climate change, will have to recognize that fact and change its ability to depend on this stuff. So I think that peak oil then has to be seen, in my view, in that way. And I think the second thing that I would say is that it was interesting, if your listeners recall, that in 2008 we had this extraordinary phenomena of a huge run-up in prices, where in a short period of time, 6 months, oil leapt up to the unprecedented height of pretty much 150 a barrel. And that was seen as precisely an indication of sort of peak oil at work, and the problems in particular of there being a limited amount of oil and this huge growth of Asian demand coming from China in particular. Now, and that was in a sense seen as a type of premonition of our peak oil future. The final thing that I would say on peak oil is that boom, bear in mind that within a matter of months, prices had crashed, wasn't simply about a scarcity of a particular commodity. It is true there was a limited amount of spare capacity in the oil system, and growing demand from oil, from Asia, had put pressure on it. But the actual explosive growth up to that 150 a barrel was, we now know, in a significant way due to speculation, which is to say that oil has become a commodity, which is not just something that's used for specific purposes, but is also an asset that can be and is speculated upon through various types of new financial instruments, which is to say those very same instruments that produced the financial crisis with the fall of Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers in late 2008, which is to say then that the peak oil question and price, what we pay for oil, may be wrapped up with one another, but there's another set of forces at work, which is the speculative economy of our forms of financial capitalism, which go through these periodic bubbles and busts. And so we need to be careful about not assuming that these price and speculative bubbles are an indication that peak oil has arrived, as much as the fact that this is a speculative type of casino capitalism that was back in 2008 actually dumping huge quantities of money into the oil futures market precisely because many investors realized that the subprime crisis was upon them. And that's what drove up not only oil but other things like food and so on. So the moral of that story is not that peak oil isn't relevant or it won't come into play at some point. It will, and it's certainly something that is going to be terribly important in understanding what the alternative to oil dependency is. But don't mix up price volatility and booms and busts, which we've experienced over the last couple of decades, with the peak oil dynamic. I think it's actually having to do with something completely different, which is really what I would refer to as the financialization of American capitalism.
Yes. Well, before we turn to alternatives and finish up, I wanted to ask one other question connected with what you've been talking about. And looking over your bibliography, one cannot help but notice certain terms, and I see the economies of violence. I see violent environments as the titles of books, the curse of black gold, and then possibly as an alternative, liberation ecologies. Could you just say what it is that you're getting at when you talk about violent environments and the economies of violence?
As I was suggesting before, you know, the history of oil and oil becoming the fuel of our civilization, if you like, is very much a violent history. And we talked a little bit about the relationship between early 20th century empire and colonization and the search for the prize, as it was called, the search for oil. But there's another way in which oil is also wrapped up with conflict and violence, and that begins to address the questions particularly of oil-producing states, those parts of the world, especially in the developing world, that are major suppliers. It may be West Africa. It may be Ecuador or Colombia, or increasingly Brazil. It may be parts of the Caspian and so on, the major supply areas, including parts of the Middle East, obviously. And one of the things that we know here is that oil, in fact, is some and oil-producing states, petro-states they're sometimes called, are characterized by what a Stanford political scientist, Terry Carl, called the paradox of plenty, which is that they're awash in oil money. Nigeria pockets $70, $80 billion a year, Saudi Arabia, three times that. They're awash in oil, and yet, in many respects, they typically underperform. Their economies tend to grow slowly. They're often characterized, in fact, by much lower development achievements, education, health, life expectancy, well-being, than you would expect from their per capita income. And often those governments are characterized by corruption, a lack of transparency, and so on. This is sometimes called the resource curse. It's the idea which came actually from a former Venezuelan president who referred to oil as the devil's excrement. And what he was getting at is that it's this fact that this oil wealth begins to sort of corrupt society, or that oil wealth is captured by governments, Venezuelan, Nigerian, Indonesian, and it produces a ferocious internal political conflict about who gets and who does not get that oil revenue, how that oil revenue is spent and distributed in Nigeria, in Ecuador, in Russia, etc. And often, of course, that oil money gets inserted into class societies, societies that are divided by religion, by ethnicity. And often oil then becomes, in a sense, fought over and becomes a source of intense political competition. And the violent economies that you refer to is simply the fact that I've been particularly interested in parts of the oil-producing world that have produced different types of social movements and, in some cases, insurgencies, in which particularly those parts of the country that produce the oil and get very little of the benefit, they may be indigenous groups in Ecuador, in the Amazon. They may be ethnic, small ethnic groups in Nigeria. Often, in fact, don't benefit. They experience all of the ecological disastrous consequences of oil, but none of its benefits. And over time, that can produce not only social movements, but in fact, military, militant responses. And since we were talking about Nigeria, that's the story of contemporary Nigeria, that oil-producing Niger Delta. In 2005, spawned a militant insurgency. It came out of a peaceful movement in the 90s by Ken Karet Sarawiwa. But the fact that those goals did not go anywhere, his movement did not go anywhere, as it were, triggered a much more militant and nasty insurgency in which groups particularly aggrieved at the fact that they have not benefited are now sabotaging governments, attacking government security forces, and attacking the oil infrastructure of the major oil companies, to the extent that by between 2005 and 2009, the national output of Nigerian oil fell by about 50% to 60%, throwing the economy into a tailspin, and of course roiling the global oil and gas markets. So it's that type of phenomena that I was particularly interested in, is that why is it, if you like, that these oil-producing regions seem to be centers of such violence and conflict? And it's obviously about both the internal politics of who benefits from the oil wealth, but also, of course, about the complicity of oil companies in that process. Oil companies who are prepared to do business with military governments. Oil companies that act irresponsibly vis-a-vis the environment. Oil companies, you know, one of the largest cases that was adjudicated through the Corrupt Business Practices Act a couple of years ago was Halliburton, the largest fine of its sort in history, some $280 million. For what? Because Halliburton paid off a number of Nigerian government officials in order to get the contract to develop a large natural liquefied gas project in Nigeria. So all of this corporate behavior is also a central element, which is generative of these sorts of grievances and conflicts that seem to be so endemic in these oil-producing states.
And liberation ecologies?
Liberation ecologies, because often one of the, if you like, the political idioms, one of the languages in which these grievances are expressed, Ken Sarawiwa is a perfect example, is an ecological language. The devastating ecological effect of the oil and gas industry, its footprint, the fact that rural and fishing livelihoods were completely undermined, is perhaps no surprise then that one of the major ways in which a critique of the oil industry and of oil-producing state was expressed by the communities themselves on the oil fields was precisely through the language of sustainability, or what we called, or I called, you know, ecological liberation, the idea that green politics, the demand for corporate accountability, for rehabilitating environments affected by oil, was part of a larger, if you like, than discourse. Again, Ken Sarawiwa is an important case in point, but just think about, for example, some of the legal cases being pursued against Chevron in Ecuador by Indian communities. They're driven by concerns over livelihood, but they're part often of larger political projects, liberatory, emancipatory projects, to not only ensure that corporations are held accountable, but to ensure that the state is held accountable, that they can in fact express their citizenship rights. And that was certainly my interpretation of, as I say, Ken Sarawiwa back in the 1990s. It was a type of green and red politics. It was green and driven in part by an environmental sensibility, which emerged out of the footprint of the oil and gas industry. But it was also a larger citizenship movement, about political rights, about excluded minorities, about making the state accountable, about ensuring that there were not fraudulent elections and so on. And so in that sense, I think the green part of this story is an important one in understanding a larger, if you like, political movement that one, I think, can see in many of these sorts of movements that tend to emerge out of these oil-producing states, whether that's Ecuador or Kazakhstan or Angola or Nigeria or wherever it may be.
Okay, this is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm hosting a special series on environment and society as it's being discussed in Northern California and on the Mendocino Coast. We're speaking today with Professor Michael Watts. He's a professor of geography at the University of California in Berkeley. He's the author of many books, in particular on the oil industry, and he's talking to us today about the politics of oil. So to finish up, Michael, let me ask you to share with us some of your thinking about the future of oil and its alternatives. I think we have all heard about British Petroleum and BP Beyond Petroleum. I know that there's a discussion going on up here about biomass and turning the forests, which are rather quiet these days into a new source of energy. I wonder if you could help us with some of your thinking about alternatives to petroleum.
Well, it's obviously a big and complicated issue and one that concerns all of us. I mean, one needs, I think, to separate out what one wants to happen from what perhaps is likely to happen. And by that I mean it's clear that our dependency on petroleum and the types of carbon emissions that are currently unsustainable in terms of their impact on global climate change and on the habitability of the Earth, that has to change, clearly. But I would say that rather than immediately talking about what the alternatives might be, I would just make two important points, I think. One is that whilst that may be the case, it's clear that the oil companies themselves, and whether that is Western, European, transnational oil companies, or big, in some cases, bigger national oil companies. Bear in mind, one of the big transformations in the oil and gas industry is that what we used to call the Seven Sisters, the super major oil companies in the 50s, and now Exxon, Chevron, etc., are at least matched in size and power and complexity by the national oil companies, Saudi Aramco, the Chinese National Petroleum Company, PDVSA in Venezuela. These are state-owned companies. They own much more oil and much more reserves than Exxon or Chevron. Their capitalization is often larger than an Exxon or a Chevron. And they produce more oil than an Exxon and a Chevron. They are huge entities. And both of these players are very much vested, even though there's a global climate change carbon emissions debate, and even though it's clear that there needs to be a move away from petroleum consumption, that, in fact, they would like to drag out that process as long as they can, because it's extraordinarily profitable. So that's the first thing. You're going to get a lot of resistance, it seems to me, precisely because we may be at peak oil or close to it and a situation of tightening demand, that there's a lot of money to be made, and there's a lot of money to be made even if Chevron and Exxon have to pay to Venezuela or Iran or to Nigerian governments 60, 70, 80 cents on the dollar for every barrel of oil. There's big money to be made. The second thing that I would say is we can see in this country already an interesting positioning around the transition to a low-carbon economy. And that is, we've seen in the last few years, the emergence of not oil, but natural gas as the transition fuel to a low-carbon economy. And the reason why I'm flagging this is that even if you think peak oil is here, we are nowhere close to peak gas. There are huge, massive reservoirs of natural gas available. And more importantly, we've seen this in the United States, that there are now a new series of technologies which permit accessing and exploiting shale gas in the shale formation, sometimes called unconventional oil and gas, in the Marcellus shales in the mid-Atlantic states or the Barnett shales in the south or the tar sands in Canada. And it's quite clear that these unconventional, and especially gas, is very plentiful and is now being positioned by the industry as not petroleum and a cleaner, more efficient fuel. And so I see a big push right now in that direction, not away from hydrocarbons, but actually of exploiting oil and, of course, being able to exploit large quantities of oil and gas that don't depend upon a Mideast or a Nigeria or an Iran or a Venezuela, but is available domestically. So I think this whole question of and struggles over both the environmental consequences of this shale gas in the U.S. We've seen a whole raft of stories in the New York Times in the last year about what is called hydraulic fracking, which is the process of how you access this gas in the shales and its huge consequences on the water table, to say nothing of the tar sands in Canada and the big debate in the last month over the new pipeline that's going to be bringing oil and gas from the tar sands. So it seems to me then that it's going to be gas that needs to be addressed in the short term, because it's clear that it's not necessarily a significantly cleaner fuel. It's not going to make a big impact, certainly, in terms of the sorts of carbon emission reductions that we need. So I think we're at a very key moment right now in terms of whatever transition to renewables or to alternative senses and types of fuel are in train. So the last thing I'd just say is regard the renewables themselves and biofuels and so on. This is obviously hugely important. But I think we've seen just in the growth of ethanol and other biofuels in the last couple of years, a couple of key sorts of issues that a transition to a zero or low carbon economy must address. One is we've seen that the biomass for these fuels has often been promoted in parts of the world, especially in the global south, and we saw this in Africa very dramatically in parts of Latin America, that are increasingly displacing foodstuff production. And so there are some real substitution costs here of whether, in fact, that expansion of ethanol production, and there's a big debate over how efficient it is as a fuel and so on, but even if that would be resolved, what that might imply in terms of food issues and food prices in an increasingly food-scarce world. So that's a key sort of issue. And the second one, of course, is whether these sorts of renewable alternatives are capable in the short term of providing the type of energetic efficiency that we have typically come to depend upon. And by energetic efficiency, I mean what everyone thinks about petroleum. It's sort of a remarkable fuel. It's stored sunlight. And when you burn it, it does release a huge amount of energy much more efficiently than other sorts of fuels. And so that's not an argument for continuing to burn it for reasons of personal transportation, for example. I think that's crazy. And I do think there are many other wonderful uses that we have for petroleum, incidentally, which don't involve carbon emissions of the sort that are entailed in the production of gasoline and using gasoline as a form of transportation. But the question still remains, and this would be my last point, that these sorts of other ethanol-type biofuels, in comparison to oil and gas, are both relatively inefficient producers of energy and would need to be mobilized on a massive scale very quickly if, in fact, we are to wean ourselves off oil and gas in a way that is not absolutely necessary because we're short of oil and gas. That's not the issue. But in order to reduce our carbon emissions that are going to have a significant enough impact on global climate systems to make our planet habitable. So I think that's the conundrum that we face. There are other sources of fuel too, of course. But I think if you talk to people in the energy industry, they all right now say the same thing. Yes, we've got to get off of this stuff, but the reality is it's going to take us 20 or 30 years of continued dependency on oil and gas before we have a significant set of renewable alternatives.
Well, thanks, Michael. That's certainly plenty for us to think about. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, as it always is. I hope that listeners will get out and get a hold of some of your books and start some serious reading there, and we'll look forward to your next visit to Mendocino County. So, Michael, thanks very much again.
Well, thank you, Cal. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, and thank you for inviting me onto the show.
So I hope listeners will return next week at this time, when our guest will be Raj Patel, who's the author of Stuffed and Starved, as well as the bestseller The Value of Nothing. Raj will talk to us about food politics. This series, broadcast at this time over the next month and a half, will include discussions of the economy, forest restoration, ocean protection, and more. This is Cal Winslow of the Mendocino Institute saying thank you for listening.